Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Radio Free Republic of Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free Republic of Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. The Taliban militants have captured dozens of districts from Afghan government forces since the start of the international military withdrawal on May 1st, which, according to the U.S. military leaders, constitutes half of all Afghan districts. While the fighting continues on multiple fronts, the Taliban's focus has been districts mainly located in northern Afghanistan. And today, almost all the Afghan districts bordering Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan are fallen to them. Though the Taliban have been saying they have no cross-border ambitions, but their focus on the north has alarmed countries across the border in Central Asia, and they are looking into these events in Afghanistan with great concern. So in this episode of the Majlis podcast, we are here to assess what's going on in northern Afghanistan, what it means for Central Asia, what the region is doing about it, where regional power stands, and what to look ahead. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Ambassador Herbst, former U.S. Ambassador to Uzbekistan and currently the Director of the Atlantic Council Azure Asia Center, Umida Hashimova, Central Asia researcher and analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis, who's originally from Uzbekistan, Amin Mudakik, the Director of Radio Free Republic of Liberty's Mashal Radio, and former Kabul Bureau Chief of our Afghan service, who is originally from northern Afghanistan, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Republic of Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us in this important conversation. So now, let's start with the latest developments in northern Afghanistan. Before I invite Amin to talk about this, I just wanted to flag an interactive map on RFRL's Gandhara subsite, providing updated territorial claims in Afghanistan. According to this map, almost all Afghan districts bordering Central Asia have fallen to the Taliban since May, which is the day when the withdrawal of the international troops began from Afghanistan. So, I mean, please kick in. What is happening on the ground in northern Afghanistan as we speak? What are some of the latest developments there?
I think I will go a little bit back what happened. I think as soon as the withdrawal of the U.S. and NATO troops started, to the surprise of most analysts, that they thought that the Taliban will start their attack from area close to the Pakistani border or southern, western Afghanistan. The Taliban swept through the rural area of the northern Afghanistan, capturing district one after another. Yeah. And today, as we speak, more than half of the districts, I can say up to 70% of the districts in northern Afghanistan are in the hand of Taliban. Only those districts which are either closer to the city or populated by Shia Hazaras, or there are a strong man, a strong warlord, or strong tribal elders in that district, these districts remain in the hand of the Afghan government. Apart from that, northern Afghanistan has three main border crossing with Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. The border crossing with Tajikistan, Sher Khan Bandar, is firmly in the hand of Taliban. Yeah. And they are running the border, and they are getting taxes. And it's to my surprise that how the Tajikistan official accept their border clearance paper while they do not recognize the Taliban. Mm. And in the same as with the Iran border crossing. But the border crossing with Uzbekistan is now in the hand of the government. It's open and it's running. And the border crossing with Turkmenistan, Akina and Faryab, is in the hand of government, but it is closed because beyond the border up to the Jawzjan capital, Shibrghan, all the highway, including the adjacent districts of Khan Charbagh and Ankhoy, are in the hand of Taliban. So the government cannot open it because they cannot move or shift goods beyond the border. Only the border area is in the hand of the Taliban.
So what you are saying, I mean, is talking about the Sher Khan Bandar, the border crossing with Tajikistan, though border crossing is at the hand of the Taliban, it's open, it's functional. Is it what you are saying?
Yes. As I talked to the Azadi correspondent, you know, a couple of days ago, he said that, yes, the border is open, but the traffic is reduced pretty much because the businessmen and traders cannot come easily. But anyway, it's open and like the crossing with Iran, Islam Khala, and Herat is also open. The traffics are coming, and the Iranian authority accepts the custom clearance of the Taliban.
Very, very interesting. Also, one other question that kind of boggles my mind is the Taliban has been present in the region for a long time, not perhaps in a position to capture or sustain their permanent dominance in any of the districts. But this time it looks like their offensive is on a whole different level. I mean, true?
This time it was a bit different. As I mean, this morning I was talking to one of the commanders, the militia commanders, or the, with what they call it, the national uprising commander in Mazar-e Sharif. He said that three things were key in Taliban success in the north. First, they were cut by surprise. The government and the district commanders, they were not ready for such a move. Secondly, they have adopted a tactic that they did not capture all the district by force. They captured the weakest district by force, and then they made this an example and sent the elders, you know, the people with gray beard, you know, which you call it Muisafid. They sent them to other districts and said that, look, if these districts could not resist us, so you cannot do this. And also in some parts, it was a bad luck, like when they started attacking Aqsa district in Jawzjan, which is one of the biggest district and key district of that area. We remember that even when President Najibullah regime was ousted, until the last moment, Wakil, the foreign minister, handed over power to Taliban, Aqsa was not fallen. District of Balkh were not fallen. But this time, they combined the tactics of dealing, negotiating, and I mean, threatening people, intimidations, and even bribing to capture all districts. So these elders, under the threat from Taliban or under the something promise or from the Taliban, succeeded to capture the districts. I mean, eyewitnesses told me that in Aqsa, 400 government soldiers surrendered to over about 50 Taliban. And when the news of this falling of big districts spread, then the other districts who are not closer to Mazar-e Sharif, or to the center of the Jawzjan and Shibragan, they did not find any reason to resist, because they say that if these big districts are falling and the government cannot come to their rescue, so why they should resist? In fact, the government was unable to logistically support all these districts before the coalition or NATO and US troops were responsible for all this logistic support, such as the oils and in all these things to in logistics to this widespread of network of districts which are around the capital. But the advantage of Taliban in this was, to my surprise, that all districts were vacated, only personnel left, all the heavy and light weapons in ammunitions were left to the Taliban. While the rule of the war is that if you are leaving a district, you destroy your ammunition. But here, everything remains intact, and the Taliban captures all of them. And that's why they are saying now they are taking these weapons and preparing to besiege the provincial capitals.
Yeah, yesterday we had another conversation which was focused on Afghanistan, in that it was clear that authorities, even though, you know, half of the districts fall into the Taliban, authorities in Afghanistan still don't have a kind of united voice how to respond to that. Some are calling for the uprising of masses, and some are saying that no, that's a dangerous way to go. So there's a confusion about that. And also, other than districts, the other day U.S. Defense Secretary General Austin was saying that 17 out of 34 Afghan provincial capitals are under stress. But you know, we are talking a lot about Afghanistan. Our focus of this discussion is supposed to be Central Asia. So when it comes to Central Asia, what does this all really mean? I mean, since the war started, intensified, over 2,000 Afghan military personnel crossed into Tajikistan seeking shelter from the advancing Taliban. As Amin was talking about, Shir Khan Bandar remains under the Taliban control, which is the Afghan crossing point into Tajikistan. And it looks like the another crossing point to Turkmenistan seems to be closed because all the surrounding areas are captured by the Taliban. So when the Central Asians kind of looks into this across the border, perhaps Umida, you would like to jump in, or maybe Ambassador Herbst, feel free to jump in. When the Central Asians look into what is going on just across the border in Afghanistan, what do they see happening?
Look, they are deeply concerned by events in Afghanistan, and they are figuring out how can they best ensure their own security and safety as a result of these developments. And they are hedging their bets. It's clear. I was in Tashkent last week for the Central Asian South Asian Summit and had a chance to speak with some Uzbek officials. I also spoke with them when they came to Washington at the end of June. And it's clear they're talking to us about ways that we might be able to help them ensure their security. Mm. At the same time that Uzbek Foreign Minister Kamilov was in town a few weeks ago, so was the Foreign Minister of Tajikistan. And of course, a senior Kazakhstani official, in fact, arrived in Washington on the same plane that I came back from Tashkent on Saturday. So they're all talking to us about their security. I am confident they're also talking to the Russians and perhaps the Chinese.
Right.
And I know for a fact regarding Uzbekistan, and believe it's true regarding the other Central Asian states, that they're in touch with the Taliban
Right,
to
yeah.
see if the Taliban have, quote unquote, learned the lesson from their last time in power. And my understanding is that the Taliban are saying, oh, yes, they've learned their lesson, and Afghanistan, under their rule, will not be a haven for terrorists from Central Asia and a place from which they can launch strikes against Central Asian countries. I'm not sure that the Central Asian states accept those assurances at face value. So, again, they're trying to sort their way through this.
So what exactly the Central Asians are talking to the United States? I mean, what they need? There are obviously you have noticed, like, there are discussions in media, in public domains, that the U.S. might be looking into possibility of establishing some sort of a interlocutor there, and that could be a base, that could be even smaller than base. So what the content of that discussion looks like?
I'm willing to say this. I mean, first of all, I'm not in the government, and so I don't have information about the current state of talks.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call even negotiations. I don't think a base is in the cards. I have, in fact, raised that possibility on my own initiative with officials from the United States and from Uzbekistan, and no one seemed to be interested in that. Although I do note with some interest the report that Moscow was offering us their bases for intel uses, and we can come back to that in a minute. But it's clear that the U.S. understands that there is a security vacuum as we and NATO depart, and they're trying to figure out some way to fill that vacuum. I hear some talk. I don't fully appreciate what it means, and I can guess, but I don't know what the people who use this phrase mean, about some over-the-horizon capacity to come back into Afghanistan. Given the reaction that I've already referred to my own mention of bases, I think over the horizon might mean more beyond the sea as opposed to on land, but I'm not certain about that.
In terms of the kind of a definitive ask Sim Master, is there anything that you would like to say in terms of what really, in definitive terms, Central Asians are seeking from the United States?
I believe they'd like to have some form of assurances from us about how we might help them. That could be in the area of intelligence. It could be the area of electronic monitoring and other monitoring of their borders. It might be in the area of equipment that could help secure borders, and maybe some sort of rapid reaction capacity, which might involve things like helicopters. But what I'm giving you right now is what seems to make sense to me as someone familiar with the region.
Yeah,
I'm not telling you this is actually what's on the table.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I believe that the Central Asian states would prefer not to take any clear step that would annoy the Taliban. And at the same time, I don't think they want to necessarily concede that the Taliban are going to win, even though right now the odds look pretty strong that that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an amazing thing to me is the way the former members of the Northern Alliance have sort of collapsed. Now, of course, that's partly the result of, I'd say, a misbegotten American policy that we're going to help create a unified Afghanistan where the government in Kabul would rule the whole country. Instead, what we seem to have done is to weaken the former members of the Northern Alliance so that the Taliban could sweep in and take over, which is not what we had in mind.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't rule out also the possibility of some quiet feelers coming from especially Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and, of course, Iran. Regarding the groups that used to comprise the Northern Alliance to see if they somehow could be reconstituted to push back against Taliban control along the various borders in the north of the country.
That's going to be an interesting development indeed if the situation goes into that direction. Of course, we know all of those Central Asian authorities do have, and I believe still maintains, their own ethnic interlocutors in northern Afghanistan that they have used in the past as a buffer zone. And also, Ambassador, just going back to a little bit into the history here is, like, you know, you were, I guess, in Uzbekistan once, you know, we have seen all those Taliban takeovers in the first place. I'm talking about the 90s and then 9/11. Happened. So if you kind of look into, draw a comparison between what the Central Asia is doing now versus what they have done in the past, what kind of stands out to you?
Look, our policy in Afghanistan over the past 20 years has been a catastrophe for the Central Asian states. I hate to say that. I played a significant role in our policy right after 9/11. But the way the Central Asians dealt with the Taliban, you know, in the late 90s and the early aughts, the first years of this century, was the Northern Alliance. And that worked pretty well for them. That sort of cordoned them off from the violence in the South. Although it is true, of course, that it was ultimately from Afghanistan that Central Asian extremists were receiving a base, receiving weapons, and they then infiltrated through the mountains of Tajikistan, then to Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan from Central Asia. So it didn't work completely, but it worked reasonably well. But again, our policy, we kicked out the Taliban, which was a good thing. But then we began a campaign to, create a single unified government, which hasn't quite worked. And as a consequence, the Northern Alliance has been severely weakened, if not basically taken off the table. So now the approach is, again, reaching out to the Taliban to see if the Taliban will behave, but also seeing what the United States might have to offer, and also what Russia might have to offer, and perhaps to a lesser extent, what China might have to offer. Though there's one more factor too. We've seen reaching out by certainly the Uzbeks to Pakistan, because we all know the vital role that Pakistan plays in enabling the Taliban. But I'm sure Pakistan will talk a good game with the Uzbeks, but I'm not sure that Uzbek concerns will loom large in Pakistan policy. One more point. In most of my work, I'm known as a very sharp critic of Putin's foreign policy. But I think that Afghanistan might be an area where Russian and U.S. interests overlap. And I wrote a piece about that. I came back from Tashkent last week. And after I wrote it, I saw the story that about the Russians offering us a base. We both have an interest in making sure that Islamic extremism does not spread into Central Asia. That's an important interest for both of us. And I think if we were able to reach a common understanding, not just with the Russians, but then also with Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, perhaps even Turkmenistan, then that this would be welcomed by the Central Asian states as a way to provide some security for them. And this is something I think we should certainly explore. But it can't be done as a U.S.-Russian condominium above the Central Asians. It has to be completely in consultation with them. And also, we do have to be careful in ways we cooperate with Moscow, especially as regards intelligence.
Yeah, certainly there is a lot to unpack. I went through your article, Ambassador. I think we will get back to the content of it in terms of the possibility or maybe areas where U.S. and Russia could cooperate in this situation in Central Asia. But also, I was interested, Umida and Bruce, your thoughts on in terms of how these scenarios looks like from Central Asian perspective, what their main concerns are. And more importantly, I guess the question should be is what they are doing about it. I mean, earlier, Omida, I was going through your story in which you kind of draw a comparison between the way Central Asians have been responding to what has been happening so far in terms of like Tajikistan opening its door for 2,000 plus soldiers come in and Uzbekistan denying their entry and Turkmenistan, God knows what it is doing about. So, from your perspective, what the Central Asians have been doing so far on what was happening?
So you're right. All three countries, bordering countries, they all have the same threat, right? It's the same development. They're all looking and watching the same activities, but they are so far responded differently, although there is a closer collaboration between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan recently in a couple, 2, 3 weeks. From the beginning, in the case of Uzbekistan, it was clear we're not letting anybody through the border, no matter what kind of situation, whether it's humanitarian or non-humanitarian. We are not allowing anybody to come through. We're treating them as violations of border and we're returning. While Tajikistan, it was complete opposite. They treated as a humanitarian case, lending a hand. They were treating some soldiers. So they allowed, at the point it went into 2,300 people. The latest developments were in Turkmenistan, and we haven't seen any reports on crossing of border, but we've seen reports that the captures what looked like from the reports, the Turkmen government immediately went into negotiations, secret negotiations with Taliban to ensure that the Turkmenistan border will not, there won't be refugee flows, and that if there is any crossings, they will be kind of returned. So, but interesting development that none of the Central Asian, three of the Central Asian countries, and even Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan, none of them condemned the developments in Afghanistan, meaning condemn they haven't condemned Taliban for the activities. So that clearly tells, kind of sends the message. They are ready to accept the outcomes, whatever it will go. They're all interested in having a kind of dominant force emerging and settling, kind of having a peace, because they're all really looking at the region as, in particular Uzbekistan, as an economic opportunity currently, and in particular in the future, was far kind of more bigger implications for the future. So they, I think, want sort of peace, and let's kind of have those kind of roads built and have a cooperation and have the Afghanistan as a kind of main transit route for a lot of the future South Asia kind of looking trade and transportation.
Bruce, you had a story about that. Although all these activities going on in Afghanistan, Uzbekistan is kind of looking into the possible trade routes with Pakistan. That was an interesting to look into. And Bruce, also the one response that we have seen so far from Central Asia, other than the way apparently kind of uncoordinated response by the countries there, one was like the military drills that are taking place across the border in Central Asia. I think yesterday Tajikistan had the military drill, and Uzbekistan is planning very soon, and that will be followed by another military drill in participation of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, led by Russia. So I wondered, what's your thought about those drills and how it relates to the kind of broader concern from Central Asia as to what's going on in northern Afghanistan?
You know, the drills, this what's happening now is all very familiar from, you know, 24 years 23 years ago or something, you know, the same thing. When the Taliban came to, started getting close to Central Asia's border, they did pretty much the same thing. You know, they had joint exercises, multilateral exercises, you know, so I'm not surprised, like, to see that Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan are all going to hold military drills. They did before, too, you know, like I said, in the late 90s when this happened. I suppose the intent is, you know, to show, one, I suppose, to ease concerns in these countries, in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, that, you know, that the people can see that they are addressing this. You know, the kind of drills that a lot of the kind of drills they do with the big tanks, and they got thousands of people and stuff out there, that, you know, people keep saying, well, you know, they're preparations for the Taliban. And I'm like, you know, and as I've said in some articles, the Taliban are not coming across the border. I mean, I don't see that. That never, you know, they're basically kind of an Afghan nationalist movement. They've never controlled the whole country, so we don't know what their intentions would be if they did. But, you know,
who's the target of those drills, then, military drills by Central Asians?
Well, see, it's, you know, because there's a lot of groups, there are some Central Asians that are in the ranks of the Taliban, and there's a lot of other groups in Afghanistan that are Central Asian groups, you know, and Amin would know too. The group they call Jundallahs, Jamaat Ansarullah, they're Tajik citizens mostly. They were the Tajik wing of the Islamic movement in Uzbekistan, you know, and there's Uzbek groups that are citizens of Uzbekistan that are also in northern Afghanistan, and some are allied with the Taliban, and some are just kind of seem to be freelancing mercenaries for the most part. But you know, it's really against them now. The, you know, big tank warfare and stuff, and anti-aircraft missiles are ineffective against this kind of a threat, you know. But it does show that there's a serious watch on the border, and a lot of the exercises they're doing are aimed at attacks by terrorist groups that take a couple buildings in a city, or get a section of the road and capture hostages somewhere on buses or something like that. So, you know, they're doing a little bit of both.
And I guess it kind of brings us back to what the ambassador was saying earlier. Like, I mean, in the light of these military drills and the ones that are coming up soon, I mean, what kind of scenario are they envisioning to develop in Afghanistan going forward is a question to be looked at going forward. Also, as you guys were talking about the individual responses by the Central Asian countries towards developing situation in Afghanistan and the type of discussions that they are having with various stakeholders. But on one hand, I also see that, you know, they are trying to be in good terms with the Taliban, as well as with the Afghan government, and also perhaps with their own ethnic interlocutors in the country who have been playing a buffer for Central Asia for a long time. So what is ahead for Central Asia as the Taliban continue their offensive? What are the seen and unseen challenges and opportunities for the region? Let's continue the debate talking about these and many other questions very shortly. first, let me recap the debate. Today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Ambassador Herbst, former U.S. ambassador to Uzbekistan and currently the director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, Omida Hashimova, Central Asia researcher and analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis, who is originally from Uzbekistan, Amin Mudakik, the director of Radio Free Europe Liberties Mashal Radio, and former Kabul bureau chief of our Afghan service, who is originally from northern Afghanistan, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the possible implications of the recent Taliban offensive in northern Afghanistan to Central Asia. So let's start with this, Ambassador. Earlier we were talking about the way Central Asians are engaging with the regional powers here. Russia seems to be active, and I was on vacation for the past 3 weeks. Perhaps I have missed some of the developments, but I think there was a meeting of the either defense minister or the one of the Russia-led organizations where the border security with Afghanistan has been discussed, and Russia has been engaged in discussions off and on with the Central Asians. But what the role Russia is playing in all this, in possibly a future Central Asia response or stand in terms of those developments in Central Asia? What's Russia's long game, Ambassador?
I think Moscow does have a great interest in making sure that Islamic extremism does not establish a true beachhead in Central Asia. They don't want that on their borders. They don't want that coming into their Islamic community. But also, you know, Moscow is in a real competition with China for influence in Eurasia. I mean, Russia was the principal outside power in Eurasia since independence. But the Chinese role is going greatly because they have a real economy, a dynamic economy, whereas Russia does not. Russians and the Chinese seem to have an understanding that Russia does economics, excuse me, Russia does the security and China does economics. But the, you know, the Chinese security footprint is growing as well. And Moscow, I think, wants to make sure that the dealing with the challenge from Afghanistan does not give China an opportunity to grow its role. And especially given, you might say, the indirect but increasingly direct Chinese contact with the Taliban, indirect through Pakistan. And so for China, the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan is a plus, whereas for Russia, it's a minus. So that's how I see the Russian game in Central Asia and Afghanistan. And this also sort of covers the Chinese game as well. As I've already mentioned, U.S. and Russian interests to a certain extent overlap. The things that would get in the way of that, of course, is Putin's revisionist policies elsewhere have led to strong American reaction to it, which makes Putin want to, in effect, strike back at the United States in all ways, including perhaps in Afghanistan. Although, again, their offer of a base suggests maybe they also see possible advantage in working with us. It is certainly in Russia's long-term interest to work with us to deal not just with the problem of extremism coming in Afghanistan, but also the growing Chinese role in Central Asia. It's just I'm not certain that Moscow completely understands that second element.
How the Central Asians view this a bigger conversation where China gets involved, Russia, perhaps the United States, I mean, the way Russia is making these offers, I mean, I don't know what the future looks like for that kind of collaboration between the United States and Russia. But what's the perspective about those kind of arrangements from Central Asia?
My sense is that if the U.S. and Russia were to agree on an overall approach, again, consulting with Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and so on, they would welcome it. You know, Russia on its own for them provokes a certain amount of fear as well. The United States, not so much fear because we are far away, but we have not been the most reliable of partners, I'm sorry to say. But if the U.S. is working with Russia, that offsets the danger to the Central Asian states of Russian designs. So that's a plus. That's why I think, again, a well thought through approach consulting the Central Asians would be welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Master. On the future challenges for Central Asia, though, of course, one cannot exclude the real possibility when the followers of the ethnic leaders like Atanur and General Dostum jumps in and things get really ugly. You know, they are mobilizing. I'm sure they have red lines. But I mean, both of these leaders have deep ties across the border with Central Asian authorities, and they have been allies in difficult times. I just wondered how this type of scenario is going to complicate Central Asia's approach towards Afghanistan. I'm sure there are more unseen challenges should things deteriorate. I just wanted to throw this on the table. So, Omida, the future challenges, how Central Asians are seeing where things are headed from here in terms of the challenges?
I feel like there are three main concerns. across the three countries. Number one concern is the possible flow of refugees. None of these countries outwardly, particularly Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, said that they are not willing to accept any refugees, although Tajikistan did say that they are willing to accept up to 10,000 refugees, but none of them willing to deal with a large amount of burden that they will see, and therefore maybe that's the reason we've seen that Tajikistan decided to send all of them back to their countries. And all this kind of financial burden that comes with all the flows, in particular some elements that can also infiltrate, that can also pose a threat. And I don't think how much the securities of those countries will be able to detect those threats from a smaller number of individuals early and to deal with that. So this number two concern, I think, is, as we mentioned, there are groups in Afghanistan that do have some aspirations, some missions in Central Asia, and I'm talking specifically Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, right? So how do you know that who of those are coming and what their plans are? So that's kind of number two, that once they cross, they can foment other groups or some other missions inside the country. Mm. And number three concern is the economic projects, the transportation projects that these countries are all planning, that whatever groups, if the Taliban comes, even though the Taliban did say that they're interested in all this, but I think they're trying to convince that it will be beneficial for the country regardless who comes to the power. And of course, Central Asian countries, in particular Uzbekistan, will have a lot more to win from that, and how to keep parties interested in those projects so they will allow this project to move forward. So yeah, as we kind of discussed that, the countries, Central Asian countries, do realize that the Taliban themselves are not the threat, and there have been several affirmations from the Taliban that that's not what they're interested, but it's all other threats that might come up as the situation becomes unstable inside Afghanistan.
You mentioned that, Omida. I mean, perhaps Bruce can jump in here. I mean, one of those elements, as you said, those, I don't know the number, perhaps hundreds and thousands, those Central Asian fighters that are based in northern Afghanistan, has been Taliban's ally for a long time, has been under the shelter or the protection of the Taliban there. Perhaps so far, maybe they have not infiltrated to Central Asian border. Now that Taliban controls throughout that area, the bordering regions of Afghanistan, and also is trying to kind of be in good terms with the Central Asians, and Central Asians are trying to be good terms with the Taliban, how those fighters factors, and now Taliban has no excuse to give them shelter if they were to be good terms with Uzbekistan. So what kind of challenge do the future of those fighters poses in Taliban and Central Asian kind of engagement, let's put it in that way?
I think as long as the Taliban are fighting in Afghanistan, they probably have use for these people, the ones that are allied with them. So,
but Central Asian authorities don't like it.
But like I said, they've pretty much cast their lot in with the Taliban at the moment. And, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan was fighting alongside the Taliban in 2001. You know, so they've already shown that they're willing to use these people, you know, for their own purposes since they're inside Afghanistan when they really need them. You know, that's, I think, part of the shift in the attitude from Central Asia to the Taliban, especially Uzbekistan, which is really, I mean, their posturing toward the Taliban this time is totally different than it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And what, because they were so hostile to the Taliban and so obviously, you know, helping out Dostum and, you know, in the north and things like that, the Taliban were able to use a group like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, you know, to distract Uzbekistan's attention, the Uzbek government's attention. They were helping the Taliban's enemies. So the Taliban sent, you know, helped out the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, sent them loose, you know, or at least supported their efforts in southern Kyrgyzstan and eastern Uzbekistan in, you know, 1999 and 2000. And the Uzbek government couldn't put all its attention on what was happening in Afghanistan. It had its own problems at home, you know. So it's useful to have those people for that reason, in case the Central Asians change their view of the situation in Afghanistan and start openly siding with the people the Taliban are fighting. If they have these people, then they can set them loose in Central Asia. You know, now if the Taliban actually controlled all of it and had it firmly under control in the north, then what do you do with these people? You know, all of a sudden they're not citizens of Afghanistan. end. There's no more fighting up there. What exactly do you do with them? You know, and that's also a problem, because I would think that the natural response would be to say, thank you for your service, and now go somewhere else, home or whatever. You know, and of course, that's a problem for the Central Asians, too. If they decide that, you know, if the Taliban say, you're bad for our image, now you're bad for our image, because we're trying to be a, you know, a legitimate government here, and housing people like you who are seen as stateless international terrorists is bad for us. So this is another problem that they got to work out, And Turkmenistan, it would be worth mentioning. I just want to mention Turkmenistan, because you'll probably remember, Mohammed, our very first podcast was because somebody crossed the Turkmen border. In 2014, twice it happened. And they killed some Turkmen border guards, and they killed some Turkmen soldiers. And after that, the Turkmen started to arm. I mean, they never had a significant military until that happened. And now they've spent, you know, we don't know how many millions of dollars buying weapons. They've drafting everyone they can into the army, you know, for the last couple of years. So it's strange to see that Niyazov, he was a kook, there was no doubt about it, but he had an understanding with the Taliban that seemed to hold up. Whereas Berdimuhamedov doesn't seem, you know, you get the feeling that Turkmenistan is not, has no assurance that there's not going to be a problem on their section of the Afghan border, which wasn't the case 20 years ago and more. I mean, they didn't need to have a big military presence, and they thought they didn't have any reason to think the Taliban was going to bother them. But for some reason, you know, in the last 7 years, they've been taking measures to make sure that, that their border is sealed as much as possible. And so their posturing toward the Taliban has changed greatly since 24 years ago. They seem to think there's a threat there. And they think that 25 years ago.
Even though, if, as Taliban say, if for a minute we believe what they say, like they don't have any cross-border ambitions, and of course, aside from all the other challenging situations that we have been talking about, the future of those fighters and then possible infiltration of refugees as a result of those fighting, I mean, how the idea or the prospect of Taliban keeping the dominance as it has currently in northern Afghanistan looks like in long term from Central Asian perspective.
Well, again, if they believe the Taliban are not going to pose a threat to them, they will establish amicable relations. That's all about their understanding of Taliban intent. And because they don't trust the Taliban, they want to see what the United States and Russia and perhaps China have to offer. It's that very pragmatic consideration.
Okay, interesting. Okay,
Mohammed, if I may jump in into that, there are a couple of kind of precedents that can kind of paint a picture of what is the future if Taliban comes to power, right? And what will be the relationship between the Central Asian countries and the Taliban? I think the Uzbek government made it clear when they started flying to Doha, having these conversations with the Taliban, that they are willing to start conversation and to accept Taliban as a partially or fully legitimate kind of power in Afghanistan. And we've seen there was examples after the seizure of the Sherhan-Bandar border post with Tajikistan. The, I believe the transportation minister of Tajikistan came with the statement that the border is functioning, that it's all open, trucks are moving, and that the Taliban are not requiring visa to the Tajik drivers. I mean, he didn't say it that the bribes were abolished by Taliban, but they said, I heard that the payments, the extra payments that used to be dealt by the drivers have not been requested. So from the Taliban point of view, they are setting this example that even if we come to your border, and I think that's mainly directed to Turkmenistan, and then Turkmenistan in particular, Uzbekistan's Hayratan border post, that even if we come, we are not closing them, and we actually will make it easier for this processing of the papers. So, yeah, I think they're kind of setting the example. It's one thing, it's a whole another question of whether they are trying to project something and that will change, or is it something that it's genuine happening? But so far, it has been kind of collaborative, right? Friendly, very entrepreneurial, which is, I mean, going back to the whole history of the Taliban, they are pretty entrepreneurial. They will seek all those opportunities, right, to deal with that. So it's more, I think, what them coming and U.S. not providing that buffer in the northern region where they used to, got rid of all those destructive forces that were interested in Central Asia, gone. Will Taliban stem them, or will Taliban, as we discussed several minutes ago, let them loose and to let them do whatever, like wreck the havoc, whatever they want? I think that's a kind of main concern within the Central Asian countries.
Yeah, also, you know, we are way out of time. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up the discussion here, but also picture this reality, like Taliban is not able to sustain the grip on power that they have at the moment. We have seen the hints, the possibilities where Atanur mobilizes his own forces and Dostum mobilizes his own forces, and there's a sort of a civil war per se in northern Afghanistan. What does that is going to mean to Central Asia, the border, and all things? I think we might need to come back to this topic sometime in the future. But just to end the conversation here with very quick points, perhaps from each of you. So, Ambassador, let's start with you. Where you will be looking at as to where things are headed from here in relations to Central Asia?
I don't think there's anyone's place to look. I think you have to look at multiple places. So again, what's happening internally within Afghanistan? The Central Asians will be watching that carefully, and they'll be, again, talking to the Taliban, talking to Ashraf Ghani. I mean, after all, they did invite Ghani as the president of Afghanistan to the Central South Asian Summit. They'll be talking to the Russians, the Chinese, and so on, and maybe then the Pakistanis, and perhaps also the Indians, as they try and figure out what's the best arrangement for them. Yeah. As we've discussed, perhaps they'll take a look at reconstituting the elements of the Northern Alliance as an option. And then they will make a pragmatic judgment as facts develop. And of course, I did not point this out, but others did smartly. You know, they could face real dilemmas regarding refugees if the Taliban does win decisively and people come out, wind up at their borders seeking refuge.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Very quick points from each of you, Amin, Omida, and Bruce. So what are some of the tipping points, maybe steps, maybe developments that you guys will be looking at? Let's start with you, Omida.
I will be really interested to see how the countries will respond. Will they remain independent kind of policies, or will they try to kind of band their forces together and finally start thinking again, as I mentioned, it's the same problem, it's the same challenges for all these countries, but are they going to bring their interests together, and maybe that will become yet another layer that will intensify this regionalization and thinking together themselves without China, without Russia, without any other power. So that would be, for me, interesting dynamic to watch.
Okay, Bruce and Amin, where you guys will be watching it. Let's start with you, Amin.
I think in the future, I don't think that this happy relations or happy marriage between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan with the Taliban will last longer, because from these two countries, there are groups formerly allied with the Taliban, IMU, Ansarullah, Jundullah, are all in Badakhshan. They have strong bases. The reason that they didn't interfere into affairs because of Russian and Taliban understanding that the Taliban promised them to keep them under control. But if the Taliban consolidate their grip on power and they are in full control of northern Afghanistan, then people from their allies, you know, these members of Ansarullah and Jundullah and IMU from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, like in the 90s, will start coming to them. And I believe that the Taliban leaders, the Taliban political leaders, whether they are in Doha or they will be in Kabul, will not be able to stop these people, because under the religious, you know, rules, under the Islamic rules, when a Muslim comes to take refuge with another Muslim, the leaders has no right to stop them. This has happened in 90s, you know, thousands of member of these militant groups from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan came and they were living openly in Kabul. So once we come to this point, this happy relation will end. But of course, the situation is different with Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan do not have any militant group. And like in the past, like in 90s, Turkmenistan had a consulate in Kabul, and had a consulate in Herat, and they have full diplomatic relation, except for some incident in the border. There was not much tension between Turkmenistan and the Taliban. Right. And also, right now, as we speak, the forces of Northern Alliance are regrouping.
Right.
General Dostum is sick, unfortunately, but his son is there. And as I was speaking to people in Mazar-e Sharif today, the government forces and the uprising forces and the district forces who retreated to Mazar-e Sharif are being trained in Mazar. They are mobilized, and they soon will start an offensive. So when the second phase of war started, involving Tajiks commanders and Uzbek commanders, they will be looking to these two countries for support.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the Tajikistan and Uzbekistan will be in a position to completely turn their face away from them because of the Taliban. So anyway, the relation between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan with Taliban will not be good in the future, I think.
Now, these are the points earlier I was trying to point at. You know, it's a very, very delicate situation. When those sort of uprising starts and they are in need of help or maybe in need of shelter, what you do? I mean, they are at the border and the Taliban are chasing them. So what you do? Send them back to the tiger's mouth? And what kind of
like what they say, the Taliban say that Afghanistan soil will not be used against any other country. They were saying this in '90s also, but Osama was there, you know, Al-Qaeda was there, and still Al-Qaeda leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is in Afghanistan. It's because the leadership has a limited power over the normal or ordinary Taliban, and as far as religion is concerned.
Yeah, well, lots of things to watch at. Bruce, what you will be watching?
Well, you know, as much as they'd like to stay out of this, I don't see how they're going to be able to. I mean, the refugee problem is a real valid point. You know, if they got, Tajikistan was saying, I think just today they said they were going to get prepared to take as many as 100,000 Afghan refugees. That's not a joke. That's exactly what was happening to them in the late 1990s. With that many people, you got that many people massing on your border, hungry, no shelter. You know, I mean, there's going to be all kinds of international organizations and individual governments saying, let them across, you know, police, as an act of mercy, let them across. That's tough. So they won't, I don't see how they can stay out of it for a long time. You know, but also, I thought Amin made a valid point there by saying, you know, the cooperation, and Amita had mentioned that too, the cooperation among the governments is going to be key, because, you know, using the example of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan at the end of the 90s, you know, when they showed up, they clearly came through the Tajik mountains, and yet the Tajik government denied that they were coming from there. They said they couldn't possibly be there. The Uzbek government was mad at the Kyrgyz government for not fighting them hard enough, not pressing the battle hard enough in 1999. And then the Uzbek and Kyrgyz government were both angry at Tajikistan because they knew that these people were in the Tajik mountains, but the Tajik government wouldn't do anything about it, and in fact said they weren't even there. I mean, you know, so this is like the worst case scenario is, you know, if someone crosses from the Tajik border and gets into Uzbekistan and sets a bomb off, are they still going to get, are the governments all still going to cooperate with each other and deal with this and figure out a way around it? Or are they going to start playing the blame game? How did they get in here? Where did they come from? Why did you let them across? You know, why didn't you see them earlier?
Yeah.
You know, that's something that the better the relations can get now, the easier it'll be to prevent something like that from happening again in the future.
Wow. There are a lot to keep our eyes on. Perhaps we will come back to this topic a little bit later in a different format. With this, let's end the discussion here. Thank you very much, Ambassador Herbst, former U.S. Ambassador to Uzbekistan, currently the Director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, Umida Hashimova, Central Asia Researcher and Analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis, Amin Mudakik, the Director of Radio Free Pride Liberties, Mashal Radio, a journalist originally from Afghanistan, and Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Pride Liberties, Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Pride Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.